Future-Proof Extra from Newstalk.
Now, pleasure in pain might be something you initially associate with sex, but actually it's a part of all of our daily lives. We see it the world over, not just in BDSM holes, but in religious fasters, ultra-marathoners and hot chili addicts who revel in the burning sensation it provides. But is this desire in all of us, or is it consigned to a select few? And why is it there at all? Well, Lee Carrot is a science journalist and author of Hurts So Good, The Science and Culture of Pain on Purpose. She joins me now. Welcome to the program, Lee. What made you want to write a book on pleasure in pain?
Well, I was a ballet dancer for about 20 years, and I think it started there. Obviously, in ballet, you're kind of indoctrinated into a cult of art and pain and discipline. And growing up in that environment, I think kind of sowed some inborn curiosity in me around why I was choosing an aversive experience and what I was getting out of it and why I kept doing it.
What is the level of pain that you endure as a ballet dancer?
A lot of it,
really?
You know? Yeah. Dancing in pointe shoes is very painful, and to an uninitiated adult, standing up in a pair of pointe shoes on point is enough to make a person pass out. And so you really kind of like, you build these muscular structures, but also there's a lot of psychological work that you have to do to be able to have like strong mind, strong body, and get through it. And obviously, as you continue doing it, it does get easier, but you know, you're still losing toenails and you're occasionally getting bloody hamburger feet. And it's just such a strange and beautiful art form. So I think that is where my interest in pain started when I was 4 years old in a ballet class.
Wow. I mean, I had heard that it was very difficult. I mean, you paint quite a vivid picture of the pain there. So we, as I said in the intro, we do endure pain. Let's move the sex thing aside just for the moment. We do endure pain quite a lot. Even just in pure exercise, we run until it hurts. We endure hot foods and so on. What is the science behind this, do we know? What is going on in the brain, or what is the explanation for why we do this sort of thing?
The short answer is that it's really fun and complicated. The longer answer has to do with the fact that pain is always contextual. It's always subjective. There's no one-to-one ratio stimuli to painful experience. Your brain takes the information from the nervous system, from your nociceptors, the neurons that signal that there may be damage happening. And your brain takes that and then looks at all of these other things at the same time. It's looking at your memories, your expectations. Have you done this before? Do you want this? Are you upset? Are you happy? And based on all of this information, creates fresh every time an experience of pain for you. And following that is this like biochemical slurry of endocannabinoids and endorphins that actually make you feel better. It's like the drugs are coming from inside the house kind of thing. And you know, anyone who like runners know this, right? Like the runner's high is such an iconic example of how our bodies can make us feel better after we felt bad. And once you understand that pain is really context dependent, it becomes easier to understand the different ways that humans like to use their own body as a playground.
So, I mean, is there a similarity in how we experience pleasure and experience pain? Are these parts of our brain close together that process these signals, or why would we experience that pleasure when, I suppose, being exposed to stimuli?
Well, I mean, that's the million-dollar question, right? Pain and pleasure are linked, and they light up so many different parts of the brain. And so much of it depends on what we want. I like to talk about ice cream in this context, because people ask me like, well, can you just like pain for pain's sake, like outside of what happens in your body? And to compare, I'm like, picture an ice cream cone. You want ice cream, you decide to get it. as you have the ice cream, you are thinking, like, your brain knows every time that you've had ice cream, like wanting ice cream, desiring ice cream, you get the biochemical slurry of all the feel-good chemicals that come from the sugar and the fat and the memories, and it's great. So do you like the ice cream, or do you like what your body does when you have ice cream, and how can you really separate the two? And pain is very similar. You know, the way what you bring to your own experience of pain, especially in the case of masochism, when you're consenting to pain, you're opting in to the aversive experience. And yeah, without that moment of consent, there is no masochism. It's just suffering at that point if you're not in control of when it starts and stops. So consenting to pain creates this kind of container for it that allows us to be curious and experience these aversive experiences and the payoff afterwards with, like, absent some of the other baggage and memories and physical reactions that might happen when we experience pain that we didn't ask for and weren't expecting. So using consent and the body's own kind of mechanics around it can really blur the lines between pleasure and desire and pain and aversion.
When we think about the pleasure that we get from pain, it's usually from when it's over. It's, you know, I feel good after I've endured something, and I go swimming in the ocean all year round. And in December, there is a real buzz you get from, you know, getting into the water, but very much getting out of the water. And it's shared by everyone. You can see everyone's face is sort of smiling after they've been battered by this freezing cold ocean.
Yeah.
What is the difference? Are we enjoying pain, or are we enjoying the release of pain?
I think that's a great question. And I think that the answer is a little bit different for everybody. I think we kind of all exist on a spectrum of masochism and sensation that we desire. And so I think for some people, they really do enjoy the pain itself and the relief afterwards. And other people maybe just kind of enjoy the relief afterwards. And because they enjoy that relief, it makes them more maybe affectionate towards or desirous of the pain in the first place. Hot sauce is a great example. I'm not really a pepperhead, but I have eaten the world's hottest pepper. And it was so painful and so wild. And afterwards, I felt so good.
Really?
Yes. Yes. I felt like euphoric for like a couple hours afterwards. I just felt great.
When pain was over, or?
It kind of overlapped. You know, the initial part of eating the pepper was like, I have never in my life felt regret so strong or so clear as when I ate that pepper. Like, in that moment, I was like, this is the stupidest thing I've ever done. I cannot believe I'm doing this right now. I've made a terrible error. And then about 10 minutes into it, I was like, I feel amazing, but also in pain. And then I just felt amazing. And the really crazy thing is I've done it again since. I swore I'd never do it again, but I felt so good afterwards that, you know, enduring the pain to get to that pleasure afterwards becomes part of the fun for me and does change how I feel about the painful experience itself, even though to me, it's still aversive.
Talk to me about the role of hormones when it comes to pain and what goes through our body when we experience pain and how that compares to when we experience something we like, for example.
So, you know, we have our bodies make endogenous morphine called endorphins. And endorphins can happen after an aversive experience to make you feel better. And they work. I mean, we discovered endorphins because they were studying opiates and realized that we had these receptors in our body already. And when you find something that we already have built in, it's kind of like, wait, why do we have receptors for this molecule that we get from a plant? And it turns out that that's part of a larger system of like regulation. And, you know, your brain is always trying to take care of your body and figure out what's happening and figure out how to keep it safe and reward it for making decisions that are good, that the brain thinks are correct for the body. And obviously I'm oversimplifying this because we are still, I mean, they're still studying what exactly happens in the runner's high. And they're still trying to figure out what exactly is happening in the brain. We know anecdotally that there is some internal pain relief. In terms of how it's using the same wetware as pleasure, right? We're using the same equipment for experience, whether we're experiencing pain or pleasure or blending the two. So teasing it apart and saying definitively, this is the route for pleasure and this is the route for pain. It makes more sense to think about them as two sides of a coin.
I would imagine that for psychologists, the people who are willing to inflict pain on themselves are a real treasure trove for research. And I'm wondering what sort of experiments you've come across where psychologists are trying to understand why people would submit to being stood on in their genital area or, whipped and so on. What sort of science has been done in this area by psychologists?
Yeah. So one of the great studies that I read about in researching this book was by Dr. Herta Flohr. And she put masochists into an fMRI machine to actually scan their brains and see what was happening. And obviously, when you are selecting for masochists that will also get in an fMRI machine and look at adult imagery, you're also kind of selecting for exhibitionists. So there's a little crossover there. But the really neat thing about her study is that she found that the same part of the brain was lighting up for masochists and non-masochists when it came to processing painful stimuli. What was different is that the brains of masochists were also accessing parts of the brain associated with memory. And so what they were doing is they're bringing their own expectations and desires to a system, to like a very basic system of pain and response that everybody has. And it was a small study and it is preliminary, but beginning to kind of piece apart like what is happening in the brain of a masochist versus someone who would never want that is a really cool area of research right now.
And so do we know what sort of people are likely to enjoy pain? Because I'm sure there's probably people listening to this program who maybe don't realize that they could be someone who really enjoys pain because they haven't, because of the cultural taboos of BDSM, for example.
Right.
So I'm wondering what sort of a person enjoys pain? Do we know?
I mean, I interviewed hundreds of people for this book. And what I found was that there are just as many routes to becoming a masochist. Some people have an event in their childhood that really sets them on this track. And it's very obvious, you can pinpoint it. Other people just started playing with it or got curious. You know, Alfred Kinsey's work in the 50s, he found that half of participants polled liked to be bitten. Half of people, that's a huge number.
Yeah.
And, you know, like given that there's so much taboo attendant to the word masochism because of where the word comes from, you know, it's named after Leopold von Sacher-Masoch, who wrote Venus and Furs and was very successful until people figured out that it wasn't entirely fictitious. It was actually expressing his own desires. Then this sexual paraphilia is named after him. He's shunned. His career is ruined. We carry that baggage with us when we talk about masochism. However, you know, we now use the word masochist to describe everything from grad students to nail biters to runners to ice water swimmers. So like the word is in cultural usage. And I think we should just kind of start to burn off some of that shame and understand that there are so many different ways to explore sensation in your body. And it's not necessarily bad or weird to explore high sensation that's a little aversive. And there's no one way to be a masochist or not.
But the reason I was asking about the personality, like, is there a certain person that tends to lean towards BDSM, is because often in films, we're given the impression that the people who are into the most extreme forms of sexual deviancy, if you want to call it that, but maybe that's something you're trying to challenge, tend to be the most conservative, the least predictable types, the most anti extrovert in real life. When you were interviewing people for this book, did you find that the people who were really into the more extreme forms of bondage and pain were also day-to-day very introvert and very inverted commas normal?
No, I found people, I was regularly surprised by who was into hardcore stuff and who wasn't. I think, you know, narratively, when we tell stories about BDSM, like, you know, thinking about like 50 Shades of Grey, wildly popular. So many people read that book. But the reality is it's a romantic story about coercion and abuse and power differentials. It doesn't really describe the day-to-day workings of BDSM, because it's a fantasy. It's a fantasy about giving up control and power. And BDSM plays with fantasy, but it's also very much to do it safely. It's very grounded in consent and communication and and safe words. And the idea that, you know, the people who are most into BDSM must have like something else going on or fit a certain stereotype.
Yeah.
It works for storytelling, but in my work, I haven't found that it really bears out that way in the real world. I'm regularly like just shocked to find out that, you know, someone I never considered or who doesn't fit that stereotype is actually into some of the most hardcore stuff I've ever heard.
That's really interesting. I'm trying to think now what the most extreme form of self-inflicted pain for pleasure is that we see, you know, from time to time. I'm wondering, did you come across something that you thought, well, that is really taking this to another level? And how did that person explain why they did what they did?
I think to me, in the course of researching the book, what I found to be the most extreme instance were the ultra marathoners. You know, I went to a race that had no end. It's called a backyard style ultra marathon. And the way it works is that everyone has 1 hour to run 4.167 miles. And so it's set that way so that after 24 hours, you've run 100 miles. And the race goes on for as long as there are runners. All you have to do is be back in the starting gate to start the next lap. And it went on for days. And like, I'm not sleeping. They're not sleeping. Like, they're just in gastric distress on a level I've never seen. Somebody fell asleep on a mailbox during the race. Someone started hallucinating in the woods and thought he was in Hong Kong. Like, the level of that to me was the most extreme example of what you can do with a body and how you can push yourself. And, you know, it's shrouded in the kind of dignity of athleticism, right? Which, you know, kind of excuses it from the way that we may be critical about BDSM. But to me, that was like the most hardcore thing that I've ever seen. And I mean, I wept. You just see people like hit the absolute end of what is possible for their body. And it felt religious and scary and like nothing I've ever seen. It was really wild. They're actually about to run that race in Tennessee this weekend again, but I'm not going to be there for this one. But it's Biggs Backyard Ultra, and they'll have information of it online if you want to follow along from home. But yeah, I've never seen anybody push themselves the way that those runners push themselves.
What I love about this book is that it explores these really interesting experiences that humans have, as well as trying to understand, at least on a moderate level, the science of what's going on. And I really enjoyed it. And thank you so much for joining us. Author of Hurts So Good, Lee Cowart. Thanks for your time.
Thank you so much for having me.